When I was sure they were gone, I shut the door and stood still in the hallway, listening to the empty house. I could feel it settling, a long whisper like shifting sand, to see what I would do now. I sat down at the bottom of the stairs. The stair carpet had been taken off, but they hadn't got around to doing anything instead. There was a wide, unvarnished band across each step, dusty and worn down in the middle by generations of feet. I leaned against the newel post, wriggled till I got my back comfortable, and thought about that diary. If it had been in Lexi's room, the bureau gang would have found it. That left the rest of the house, the whole garden, and the question of what was in there that she had wanted to hide, even from her best friends. For a second I heard Frank's voice in the squad room. Her friends close and her secrets closer. The other possibility was that Lexi had kept it on her, that she had had it in a pocket when she died, and the killer had nicked it. That would explain why he had taken the time and the risk to go after her, pulling her into cover. Black darkness, and his hands moving fast over her limp body, patting down pockets, glazed with rain and blood, if he needed that diary. That fit with what I knew about Lexi. Keep secrets close. But on a more practical level, it would have had to be pretty small to go into a pocket, and she would have had to swap it over every time she changed clothes. Finding a hiding place would have been simpler and safer. Somewhere it would be safe from rain and from accidental discovery. Somewhere she could be sure of privacy, even living with four people. Somewhere she could go whenever she wanted, without catching anyone's attention. Not her room. There was a toilet on the ground floor and a full bathroom on the first. I checked the jacks first, but the room was the size of a coat closet, and once I'd looked in the cistern, I had basically exhausted the possibilities. The main bathroom was big, 1930s tiles with a black and white checkered border, chipped bath, unfrosted windows with tattered net curtains. The door bolted. Nothing in the cistern or behind it. I sat down on the floor and pulled out the wooden panel from the side of the bath. It came easily, a scraping sound, but nothing that running water or a flush wouldn't cover. Underneath there were cobwebs, mouse droppings, sweeps of finger marks in the dust, and, tucked in a corner, a tiny red notebook. My breath felt like I'd been running. I didn't like this. Didn't like how, with acres to choose from, I had come homing straight to Lexi's hiding place, as if I had no choice. Around me the house seemed to have tightened and drawn closer, leaning in over my shoulder, watching, focused. I went up to my room, Lexi's room, and found my gloves and a nail file. Then I sat back down on the bathroom floor and carefully, holding it by the edges, pulled out the notebook. I used the file to turn the pages. Sooner or later, the bureau would need to fingerprint this. I had been hoping for a pour-your-heart-out diary, but I should have known better. This was just a date book. Red fake leather cover, a page for each day. The first few months were covered with appointments and reminders in that quick, rounded writing. Lettuce, brie, garlic salt, 11 Tut, room 3017, elec bill. Ask D. Ovid book. Homey, innocuous stuff. And reading it made me edgier than anything yet. When you're a detective, you get used to invading people's privacy in every way you can think of. I had slept in Lexi's bed and I was wearing her clothes. But this was the small day-to-day debris of her life. It had been only for herself and I had no right to it. In the last few days of March, though, something changed. The shopping lists and tutorial timetables vanished, and the pages went bare. There were only three notes in a hard, dashed-off scribble. The last of March, 10:30 N. The 5th of April, 11:30 N. On the 11th, 2 days before she died, 11 N. No N in January or February. No mention till that appointment on the last of March. The list of Lexi's KAs wasn't a long one, and as far as I could remember, no one on it began with N. A nickname? A place? A cafe? Someone from her old life, just like Frank had said, resurfacing from nowhere and wiping the rest of her world blank? Across the last 2 days of April was a list of letters and numbers in that same furious scrawl. AMS 79, LHR 34, EDI 49, CDG 59, ALC 104. Scores from some game? Sums of money she had lent or borrowed? Abby's initials were AMS, Abigail Marie Stone. But the others didn't match anyone on the KA list. I stared at them for a long time, but the only thing they reminded me of was the plate numbers on classic cars, and I couldn't for the life of me think of a reason why Lexi would be car spotting, or why, if she was, it would be a state secret. Nobody had said one word about her acting tense or odd her last few weeks. She seemed fine. Every single interviewee had told Frank and Sam she seemed happy, she seemed just like always. The last video clip was from 3 days before she died, and it showed her clambering down a ladder from the attic. A red bandana tied around her hair, and every inch of her powdered grey with dust, sneezing and laughing, and holding out something in her free hand. "No, look, Rafe, look! It's..." Explosive sneeze. "It's opera glasses! I think they're mother of pearl, aren't they brilliant?" Whatever had been going on, she had hidden it well. Too well. The rest of the book was empty, except for the 22nd of August. Dad's B-Day. Not a changeling or a collective hallucination, after all. She had a father, somewhere out there, and she hadn't wanted to forget his birthday. She had kept at least one slender tie to the life where she had started out. I went through the pages again, slower this time, looking for anything I'd missed. Towards the beginning, a few dates here and there were circled. 2 January, 29 January, 25 February. The first page had a tiny calendar for December 2004, and sure enough, there was a circle around the 6th. 27 days apart. Lexi had been clockwork, and she had kept track. By the end of March, with no circle around the 24th, she had to have suspected she was pregnant. Somewhere, not at home, at Trinity or in some cafe where nobody would see the packet in the bin and wonder, she had taken a pregnancy test, and something had changed. Her date book had turned to a fierce secret. N had moved in, and everything else had been stripped away. N, an obstetrician? A clinic? The baby's father? "What the hell were you at, girl?" I said softly into the empty room. There was a whisper behind me, and I jumped about a mile. But it was only the breeze riffling the net curtains. I thought about taking the date book back to my room, but in the end, I figured Lexi had probably had reasons of her own for not leaving it there, and her hiding place had apparently worked fine so far. I copied the good bits into my own notebook, put hers back under the bath, and slid the panel into place. Then I went over the house, getting to know the details and doing a quick, not too thorough search as I went. Frank would expect to hear that I'd done something useful with my day, and I already knew I wasn't going to tell him about the date book, at least not yet. I started at the bottom and worked my way up. If I found anything good, we were going to have a major admissibility battle on our hands. I was a resident of the house, which meant I could look in the common spaces all I wanted, but the others' rooms were basically out of bounds. And I was there under false pretenses to begin with. This is the kind of tangle that buys lawyers new Porsches. Once you know what you're chasing, though, you can almost always find a legit way to get to it. The house had that effortlessly off-kilter feel of something out of a storybook. I kept expecting to fall down a secret staircase or come out of a room into a completely new corridor that only existed on alternate Mondays. I worked fast. I couldn't make myself slow down, couldn't shake the feeling that somewhere in the attic a huge clock was counting down, great handfuls of seconds tumbling away. On the ground floor were the double sitting room, the kitchen, the toilet, and Rafe's room. Rafe's room was a mess. Clothes piled in cardboard boxes, sticky glasses and snowdrifts of paper everywhere. But in an assured way. You could tell he usually knew where everything was, even if no one else could work it out. He had been goofing off on one wall with charcoal, dashing off quick, fairly impressive sketches. For some kind of mural involving a beech tree, a red setter, and a guy in a top hat. On the mantelpiece was Eureka, the head. A porcelain phrenology bust, staring loftily out over Lexi's red bandana. I was starting to like Rafe. The first floor had Abby's room and the bathroom at the front. Justin's and a spare room to the back. Either it had been too complicated to clear out, or Rafe liked being on his own downstairs. I started with the spare. The thought of going into either of the others put a small, ridiculous, nasty taste in my mouth. Great Uncle Simon had obviously never ever thrown anything away. The room had a schizophrenic, dreamlike look, some lost store cupboard of the mind. Three copper kettles with holes in them, a moldy top hat, a broken stick horse giving me a godfather leer. What appeared to be half of an accordion. I know nothing about antiques, but none of it looked valuable. Definitely not valuable enough to kill for. It looked more like stuff you would leave outside the gate in the hope that drunk students on a kitsch kick would take it home. Abby and Justin were both neat, in very different ways. Abby went in for knick-knacks, a tiny alabaster vase holding a handful of violets, a lead crystal candlestick, an old sweet tin with a picture of a red-lipped girl in an improbable Egyptian get-up on the lid. All shiny clean and lined up carefully on just about every flat surface. And color? The curtains were made of strips of old fabric sewn together. Red damask, bluebell sprigs cotton, frail lace. And she had glued patches of fabric over the bald spots in the faded wallpaper. The room felt cozy and quirky, and a little unreal. Like the den of some kid's book woodland creature that would wear a frilly bonnet and make jam tarts. Justin, sort of unexpectedly, turned out to have minimalist tastes. There was a small nest of books and photocopies and scribbled pages beside his bedside table, and he had covered the back of his door with photos of the gang, arranged symmetrically, in what looked like chronological order, and covered with some kind of clear sealant. But everything else was spare and clean and functional. White bedclothes, white curtains blowing, dark wood furniture polished to a shine, neat rows of balled-up socks in the drawers, and glossy shoes at the bottom of the wardrobe. The room smelled, very faintly, of something cypressy and masculine. There was nothing dodgy in any of the bedrooms, as far as I could see, but something about all three of them kept catching at me. It took me a while to put my finger on it. I was kneeling on Justin's floor, checking under his bed like a burglar. Nothing, not even dust bunnies. When it hit me, they felt permanent. I had never lived in a place where I could mess with the wallpaper or glue things down. My aunt and uncle wouldn't have objected, exactly. But their house had a tiptoe atmosphere that prevented anything along those lines from even occurring to me. And all my landlords apparently had this idea that they were renting me Frank Lloyd Wright's finest. It had taken me months to convince my current guy that property values would not plummet if I painted the walls white instead of banana barf yellow, and stuck the LSD-based carpet in the garden shed. None of this had bothered me at the time. But all of a sudden, surrounded by this house full of happy cavalier possessiveness, I would have loved a mural. Sam can draw. It seemed like a very strange way to live, on some stranger's sufferance, asking permission like a little kid before I left any mark. The top floor, my room. Daniel's. Two more spares. The one beside Daniel was full of old furniture, tumbled in splayed heaps as if an earthquake had hit. Those greyish undersized chairs that never actually get used. A display cabinet that looked like the Rococo movement had thrown up on it. And just about everything in between. Bits and pieces had obviously been taken out. Drag marks, bare patches. Presumably to furnish the rooms when the five of them moved in. What was left was inches deep in trailing sticky dust. The room next to mine had more wild debris. A cracked stone hot water bottle. Mud-crusted green wellies. A mouse-shredded tapestry cushion involving deer and flowers. And teetering stacks of cardboard boxes and old leather suitcases. Someone had made a start in going through this stuff not too long ago. Layers of bright finger marks on some of the suitcase lids. One even wiped semi-clean. Mysterious outlines in corners and on boxes where things had been taken away. There were tangles of faint shoe prints on the dusty floorboards. If you were going to hide something, a murder weapon, or some kind of evidence, or some small priceless antique, this wouldn't be a bad place. I went through all the cases that had been opened, staying well clear of the finger marks just in case. But they were stuffed to the lids with pages and pages of crabby fountain pen scribble. As far as I could tell, someone, presumably Great Uncle Simon, had been writing a history of the March family through the ages. The Marches had been around for a while. The dates went back to 1734, when the house had been built, but had apparently never done anything more interesting than getting married, buying the odd horse, and gradually losing most of their estate. Daniel's room was locked. The life skills I learned from Frank do include lockpicking, and this one looked pretty simple. But I was already antsy from the diary, and that door wound me a notch tighter. I had no way of knowing whether Daniel always locked his room, or whether this was specifically for me. I was suddenly positive that he had left some trap, a hair across the frame, a glass of water just inside the door, that would give me away if I went in there. I finished off with Lexi's room. It had been searched already, but I wanted to do it myself. Unlike Uncle Simon, Lexi had kept sweet fuck all. The room wasn't tidy exactly. The books were tossed onto the shelves rather than lined up. The clothes were mostly in piles on the wardrobe floor. Under the bed were three empty smoke packets, half a caramilk, and a crumpled page of notes on Villette. But it was too sparse to be messy. No knick-knacks, no old ticket stubs or birthday cards or dried flowers, no photographs. The only mementos she had wanted were the phone videos. I thumbed through every book and turned every pocket inside out, but the room gave me nothing. It had that same taste of permanence, though. She had been trying out paint colors on the wall beside her bed, in broad, fast sweeps, ochre, old rose, china blue. That flick of envy went through me again. "Screw you," I told Lexi inside my head. "You may have lived here for longer, but I'm getting paid for it." I sat down on the floor, dug my mobile out of my bag and rang Frank. "Hey, babe," he said on the second ring. "Burned already, yeah?" He was in a good mood. "Yeah," I said. "Sorry about that. Come get me." Frank laughed. "How's it going?" I stuck him on speakerphone, put the phone on the floor beside me, and stuffed my gloves and notebook back into the bag. "Okay, I guess. I don't think any of them suspect anything's up." "Why would they? Nobody in their right mind would think of something this unlikely. Got anything good for me?" "They're all at college, so I had a quick look around the house. No bloody knife, no bloody clothes, no Renoirs, no signed confessions, not even a stash of spliff or a porn mag. They're awfully pure for students." My bandages were in carefully numbered packets, so that the stains would get lighter as the wounds supposedly healed, just in case someone with a very weird mind was checking the bin. In this job, you leave room for a fair amount of weirdness. I found the bandage marked 2 and peeled off the wrapper. Whoever had done the staining lived life with enthusiasm. Any sign of that diary? Frank asked. The famous diary that Daniel saw fit to mention to you, but not to us? I leaned back against the bookshelf, hiked up my top and pulled off the old bandage. If it's in the house, I said, someone's done a good job of hiding it. A non-committal noise from Frank. Or else you were right and the killer took it off her body. Either way, though, it's interesting that Daniel and company felt the need to lie about it. Anyone acting dodgy? No, they were a little awkward around me to start with, but they would be. Basically, the main thing I'm getting is they're glad to have Lexi back. That's what I got from the mic feed, which, Frank said, reminds me. What happened last night after you went up to your room? I heard you talking, but somehow I had trouble catching the exact words. There was a different note in his voice, and not a good one. I stopped smoothing down the edges of the new bandage. Nothing. Everyone said good night. How sweet, Frank said. Very Waltons. I'm sorry I missed it. Where was your mic? In my bag. The battery pack sticks into me when I sleep. So sleep on your back. Your door doesn't lock. I put a chair in front of it. Oh, well then, that's all the backup you need. Jesus, Cassie. I could practically see him raking his free hand furiously through his hair, pacing. What's the big deal, Frank? Last time I never even used the mic unless I was actually doing something interesting. Whether I talk in my sleep isn't going to make or break this case. Last time you weren't living with suspects. These four may not be on top of our list, but we haven't eliminated them yet. Unless you're in the shower, that mic stays on your body. You want to talk about last time? If your mic had been in your bag where we couldn't hear you, you'd be dead. You'd have bled out before we could get to you. Yeah, I said. Point taken. Got it? On your body at all times. No fucking about. Got it. Okay then, Frank said, settling down. I've got a little prezi for you. There was the edge of a grin in there. He'd saved up something good for after the lecture. I've been tracking down all your KAs from our first Lexi Madison extravaganza. Remember a girl called Victoria Harding? I bit off a piece of surgical tape. Should I? Tallish, slim, long blonde hair. Talks 100 an hour. Doesn't blink. Oh, God, I said, taping the bandage down. Sticky Vicky. There's a blast from the past. Sticky Vicky was in UCD with me, studying something non-specific. She had glassy blue eyes, a lot of matching accessories and a frantic, limitless ability to octopus herself onto anyone who might be useful, mainly rich boys and party girls. For some reason she had decided I was cool enough to be worth it, or maybe she was just hoping for free drugs. The very one. When did you last talk to her? I locked my bag and shoved it under the bed, trying to think back. Vicky wasn't the type that leaves a lasting impression. Maybe a few days before I got pulled out. I've seen her around town once or twice since, but I always dodged. That's funny, Frank said with that wolfish grin spreading through his voice. Because she's talked to you a lot more recently than that. In fact, you and she had a nice long chat in early January of 2002. She knows the date because she'd just been to the winter sales and bought some kind of fancy designer coat, which she showed to you. Apparently, it involved, and I quote, the absolute ultimate taupe suede. Whatever class of animal a taupe may be. Ringing any bells? No, I said. My heart was going slow and hard. I could feel it right down to the soles of my feet. That wasn't me. I figured it might not be. Vicky remembers the conversation vividly, though, almost word for word. The girl's got a memory like a steel trap. She'll make a dream witness if it ever comes to that. Want to hear what you talked about? Vicky always did have that kind of mind. Since there was basically no activity going on inside her head, conversations went in there and came back out virtually untouched. It was one of the main reasons I'd spent any time with her. Refresh my memory, I said. You ran into each other on Grafton Street. According to her, you were totally spacey. Didn't remember her at first, Weren't sure when you'd last seen each other. You claimed to have a foul hangover, but she put it down to that awful nervous breakdown she'd heard about. Frank was enjoying this. His voice had a fast, focused predator on the move rhythm. I was having a lot less fun than he was. I had known all this already. Only the specifics had been missing, and being right wasn't as satisfying as you might think. Once you managed to place her, though, you were very friendly. You even suggested going for a coffee to catch up. Whoever our girl was, she had some nerve. Yeah, I said. I realized I was crouched like a sprinter, ready to leap. Lexi's bedroom felt mocking and tricky around me, humming with secret drawers and fake floorboards and spring traps. She had that all right. You went to the cafe in Brown Thomas. She showed you her fashion finds and you both played Do You Remember for a while. You, amazingly enough, were pretty quiet. But get this. At one point, Vicky asked you whether you were in Trinity these days. Apparently, not long before you had had your nervous breakdown, you told her you were sick of UCD. You were thinking of transferring somewhere else, maybe Trinity, maybe abroad. Sound familiar? Yeah, I said. I sat down carefully on Lexi's bed. Yeah, it does. It had been getting towards the end of term, and Frank hadn't told me whether the operation was going to continue after the summer. I was setting up an exit, in case I needed one. The other point of Vicky, you could always rely on her to get gossip all around college in no time flat. My head was spinning, strange-shaped things rearranging themselves and falling into new places with soft little clicks. The coincidence of Trinity. This girl heading straight for my old college, picking up where I had left off, had given me the creeps all along. But this was almost worse. The only coincidence was two girls running into each other in a small city, and Sticky Vicky spends most of her time hanging around town looking for useful people to run into anyway. Lexi hadn't ended up in Trinity by chance, or by some dark magnetic pull that had her shadowing me, elbowing her way into my corners. I had suggested it to her. We had worked together seamlessly, she and I. I had drawn her to this house, this life, every bit as neatly and surely as she had drawn me. Frank was still going. Our girl said no, she wasn't in college at the moment, she had been travelling. She was vague about where. Vicky assumed she'd been in the funny farm. But here's the good part. Vicky figured it was a funny farm in America, or maybe Canada. Partly, that's because she remembers your imaginary family was living in Canada. But mostly, it's because somewhere between your time in UCD and that day on Grafton Street, you've picked up a fairly serious tinge of American accent. So not only do we know how this girl got hold of the Lexi Madison ID, and when, but we've got a pretty good idea of where to start looking for her. I think we may owe Sticky Vicky a cocktail or two. Sooner you than me, I said. I knew my voice sounded weird, but Frank was too hyped up to notice. I put in a call to the FBI boys and I'm about to email them over prints and photos. There's a good chance our girl was on the run in one way or another, so they might turn up something. Lexi's face watched me warily, in triplicate, from the dressing table mirror. Keep me updated, okay? I said. Anything you get. Will do. Want to talk to your fella? He's here. Sam and Frank sharing an incident room. Jesus. I'll call him later, I said. The deep murmur of Sam's voice in the background, and for a split second, out of nowhere, I wanted to talk to him so badly it almost doubled me over. He says he's got through your last 6 months in murder, Frank told me, and all the people you might have pissed off are out, one way or another. He'll keep working backwards and keep you up to speed. In other words, this had nothing to do with Operation Vestal. God. Sam. Second hand and at a distance, he was trying to reassure me. He was quietly, doggedly going after the only threat that he understood. I wondered how much he had slept the night before. Thanks, I said. Tell him thanks, Frank. Tell him I'll talk to him soon. I needed to get outdoors. partly because of eyeball overload, all those strange dusty objects, and partly because the house was starting to do things to the back of my neck. It made the air around me feel too intimate and too knowing, like an eyebrow flick from someone you never could fool. I hit the fridge, made myself a turkey sandwich. This gang believed in good mustard. And a jam sandwich and a thermos of coffee, and took them on a long walk. Sometime very soon I was going to be navigating Glenskeehy in the dark, quite possibly with input from a killer who knew the area like the back of his hand. I figured it might be a good idea to get my bearings. The place was a maze, dozens of single-file lanes twisting their way among hedges and fields and woods from nowhere much to nowhere much else. But it turned out I knew my way around better than I'd expected. I only got lost twice. I was starting to appreciate Frank on a whole new level. When I got hungry, I sat on a wall and had my coffee and sandwiches, looking out over the mountainsides and giving the mental finger to the DV squad room and Maher and his halitosis problem. It was a sunny, snappy day, hazy clouds high in a cool blue sky. But I hadn't seen a single human being anywhere along the way. Somewhere far off a dog was barking and someone was whistling to him, but that was it. I was developing a theory that Glenskeehy had been wiped out by a millennium death ray, and no one had noticed. On my way back, I spent a while checking out the Whitethorn house grounds. The Marches might have lost most of their estate, but what was left was still pretty impressive. Stone walls higher than my head, lined with trees, mostly the hawthorns that had given the house its name. But I spotted oak, ash, and apple just going into bloom. A broken-down stable discreetly out of smelling range of the house, where Daniel and Justin kept their cars. It would have held 6 horses way back when. Now it was all piles of dusty tools and tarps. But they didn't look like they'd been touched in a very long time, so I didn't poke around. To the back of the house was that great sweep of grass, maybe 100 yards long, bordered by a thick rim of trees and stone wall and ivy. At the bottom was a rusty iron gate, the gate Lexi had gone through that night when she walked out onto the last edge of her life. And, tucked away in a corner, a wide, semi-organized patch of shrubs. I recognized rosemary and bay, the herb garden Abby had mentioned the evening before. That already seemed like months ago. From that distance, the house looked delicate and remote, something out of an old watercolor. Then a fast little wind rippled down the grass, lifting the long trails of ivy, and the lawn tilted under my feet. By one of the side walls, only 20 or 30 yards from me, there was someone behind the ivy. Someone slight and dark as a shadow, sitting on a throne. The hair on the back of my neck rose a slow wave. My gun was still taped to the back of Lexi's bedside table. I bit down hard on my lip and grabbed a heavy fallen branch out of the herb garden without taking my eyes off the ivy, which had dropped innocently back into place. The breeze was gone. The garden was still and sunny as a dream. I walked along the wall, casually but fast, flattened myself against it, got a good grip on my branch, and whipped back the ivy in one sharp move. There was no one there. The tree trunks and overgrown branches and ivy made an alcove against the wall, a little sun-splashed bubble. In it were 2 stone benches, and between them, a thread of water trickling through a hole in the wall and down shallow steps to a tiny murky pond. Nothing else. Shadows tangled together, and for a second I caught the illusion again, the benches turning high-backed and sweeping, that slim figure sitting upright. Then I let the ivy fall, and it was gone. Apparently it wasn't just the house that had a personality all its own. I got my breath back and checked out the alcove. The seats had traces of moss in the cracks, but most of it had been scrubbed away. Someone knew about this place. I considered its potential as a rendezvous point, one way or another. but it was awfully close to the house to be inviting outsiders around. And the mat of leaves and twigs around the pond looked like it hadn't been disturbed in a while. I brushed at it with the side of my shoe and got wide, smooth flagstones. Metal glinted in the dirt and my heart bounced. Knife? But it was too small. A button. Lion and unicorn, battered and dented. Someone long ago had been in the British Army. The hole letting the water in through the garden wall was choked with muck. I stuck the button in my pocket, knelt down on the flagstones and used the branch in my hands to clear it out. It took a long time. The wall was thick. When I was finished, there was a mini waterfall, murmuring happily to itself, and my hands smelled of earth and decaying leaves. I rinsed them off and sat on one of the benches for a while, having a smoke and listening to the water. It was nice in there, warm and still and secret, like an animal's den or a kid's hideout. The pond filled up, tiny insects hovering above the surface. The extra water drained away through a tiny gutter into the ground. I picked out floating leaves, and after a while the pond was clear enough that I could see my reflection rippling. Lexi's watch said 4:30. I had made it through 24 hours, and probably knocked a good handful of people out of the incident room sweepstakes. I put my cigarette butt back in the pack, ducked out through the ivy, and went inside to catch up on thesis notes. The front door opened smoothly to my key. The air inside stirred as I came in, and it didn't feel over-intimate anymore. It felt like a slight smile and a cool, brief touch on the cheek, like a welcome. Chapter 7. That night, I went for my walk. I needed to phone Sam, and anyway, Frank and I had decided that I was better off getting Lexi back into her normal routine as fast as possible. Not playing the trauma card too hard, at least not yet. There were bound to be little differences anyway, and with any luck people would use the stabbing to explain those away. The more I pushed it, the more likely it was that someone would think, gee, Lexi's a completely different person now. We were in the sitting room, after dinner. Daniel and Justin and I were reading. Rafe was playing piano, a lazy Mozart fantasia, breaking off now and then to repeat a phrase he liked or had messed up the first time. Abby was making her doll a new petticoat out of old broidery anglaise, head bent over stitches so tiny they were almost invisible. I didn't think the doll was creepy, exactly. She wasn't one of the ones that looked like puffy, deformed adults. She had a long dark plait and a wistful, dreamy face with a tip-tilted nose and tranquil brown eyes. But I could see the guy's point all the same. Those big, sad eyes staring at me from an undignified position on Abby's lap made me feel guilty in a non-specific way. And there was something disturbing about the fresh, springy curl of her hair. Around 11, I went out to the coat closet for my runners. I had wriggled into my super sexy girdle and tucked my phone in there before dinner, so I wouldn't have to break routine by going up to my room. Frank would be proud of me. I did a wince and a little under my breath, ow, as I sat down on the hearth rug, and Justin's head snapped up. Are you all right? Do you need your painkillers? No, I said, disentangling my shoelace. I just sat down funny. Walk? Abby asked, glancing up from the doll. Yep, I said, pulling on one of the runners. It had the shape of Lexi's foot, a fraction narrower than mine, printed on the insole. That tiny suspension all through the room again, like a caught breath. Rafe's hands left a cord hanging in the air. Is that wise? Daniel inquired, putting a finger in his book to mark his page. I feel fine, I said. The stitches don't hurt unless I twist sideways. Walking isn't going to burst them or anything. That's hardly what I had in mind, Daniel said. You're not concerned? They were all looking at me, that unreadable quadruple gaze with the force of a tractor beam. I shrugged, pulling at a shoelace. No. Why not, if I may ask? Rafe moved, threw a taut little trill somewhere in the piano's upper octaves. Justin flinched. Cause, I said, I'm not. Shouldn't you be? After all, if you have no idea, Daniel, Rafe said, almost under his breath. Leave her alone. I wish you wouldn't go out there, Justin said. He looked like his stomach hurt. I really do. We're worried, Lex, Abby said quietly, even if you're not. The trill was still going, on and on like an alarm bell. Rafe, Justin said, pressing a hand to his ear. Stop! Rafe ignored him. Like she's not enough of a drama queen without you three encouraging her. Daniel didn't seem to notice. Do you blame us? He asked me. So you'll just have to worry, I said, shoving my other foot into its shoe. I don't care. If I get all jumpy now, I'll be jumpy forever, and I'm not doing that. Well, congratulations, Rafe said, ending the trill with a neat chord. Take your torch. See you later. He turned back to the piano and started flipping pages. And your phone, Justin said, in case you feel faint or... His voice trailed off. It doesn't seem to be raining any more, Daniel said, peering at the window. But it might be chilly. Are you going to wear the jacket? I had no idea what he was talking about. This walk seemed to be turning into something at the organization level of Operation Desert Storm. I'll be fine, I said. Daniel said, considering me. Maybe I should go with you. No, Rafe said abruptly. I'll go. You're working. He banged the piano lid down and stood up. Bloody hell, I snapped, throwing my hands up and giving the four of them an outraged glare. It's a walk. I do it all the time. I'm not taking protective clothing, and I'm not taking emergency flares, and I'm definitely not taking a bodyguard. Is that okay with everyone? The thought of a private chat with Rafe or Daniel was interesting, but I could get those some other time. If someone was waiting for me out in the lanes, the last thing I wanted was to scare him off. That's my girl, said Justin, giving me a faint smile. You'll be fine, won't you? At the very least, Daniel said, unperturbed, you should take a different route from the one you took the other night. Will you do that? He was watching me blandly, one finger still caught between the pages of his book. There was nothing in his face except mild concern. I'd love to, I said, if I remembered which way I went. Since I don't have the first clue, I'll just have to take my chances, won't I? Ah, Daniel said, of course, I'm sorry. Ring if you want one of us to come meet you. He went back to his book. Rafe thumped down onto the piano stool and crashed into the Rondo alla Turca. It was a bright night, the moon high in a clear, cold sky, flicking chips of white off the dark hawthorn leaves. I buttoned Lexi's suede jacket up to my neck. The torch beam lit up a narrow bar of dirt path, and the invisible fields felt suddenly huge around me. The torch made me feel very vulnerable and not very smart. But I kept it on. If anyone was lurking out there, he needed to know where to find me. No one came. Something shifted off to one side, something heavy, but when I whipped the torch around, it was a cow, staring back at me with wide, sorrowful eyes. I kept walking, nice and slow like a good little target, and thought about that exchange back in the sitting room. I wondered what Frank had made of it. Daniel could have been simply trying to jog my memory loose, or he could have had very good reasons for wanting to check whether the amnesia was real, and I had no idea which it was. I didn't realize I was heading for the ruined cottage until it rose up in front of me, a smudge of thicker dark against the sky, stars flickering like altar lights in the windows. I switched off the torch. I could find my way across the field without it, and a light in the cottage was likely to make the neighbors very antsy, possibly even antsy enough to come investigating. The long grass swished, a soft, steady sound, around my ankles. I reached up and touched the stone lintel like a salute before I went in through the doorway. The quality of the silence was different inside, deeper, and so thick I could feel it pressing softly around me. A slip of moonlight caught the crooked stone of the hearth in the inner room. One wall sloped jaggedly down from the corner where Lexi had curled up to die, and I pulled myself up onto it and settled my back against the gable end. The place should probably have freaked me out. I was so close to her dying. I could have leaned down across 10 days and touched her hair, but it didn't. The cottage had a century and a half of its own stillness stored up. She had taken only an eye blink. It had already absorbed her and closed over the place where she had been. I thought about her differently that night. Before, she had been an invader or a dare, always something that set my back stiffening and my adrenaline racing. But I was the one who had flashed into her life out of nowhere, with Sticky Vicky for a pawn and a wild why-not chance dangling from my fingertips. I was the dare she had taken, years before the flip side of the coin landed in front of me. The moon spun slowly across the sky, and I thought of my face blue-gray and empty on steel in the morgue, the long rush and clang of the drawer shutting her into the dark, alone. I imagined her sitting on the same bit of wall on other lost nights, and I felt so warm and so solid, firm-moving flesh overlaid on her faint, silvery imprint. It almost broke my heart. I wanted to tell her things she should have known, how her tutorial group had coped with Beowulf, and what the guys had made for dinner, what the sky looked like tonight, things I was keeping for her. In the first few months after Operation Vestal, I thought a lot about leaving. It seemed paradoxically like the only way I could ever feel like me again. Pack my passport and a change of clothes, scribble a note, "Dear everyone, I'm off, love Cassie," and catch the next flight to anywhere, leave behind everything that had changed me into someone I didn't recognize. Somewhere in there, I never knew the exact moment, my life had slipped through my hands and smashed to smithereens. Everything I had, my job, my friends, my flat, my clothes, my reflection in the mirror, felt like it belonged to someone else. Some clear-eyed, straight-backed girl I could never find again. I was a wrecked thing, smeared over with dark finger marks and stuck with shards of nightmare. And I had no right there anymore. I moved through my lost life like a ghost, trying not to touch anything with my bleeding hands, and dreamed of learning to sail in a warm place, Bermuda or Bondi, and telling people sweet, soft lies about my past. I don't know why I stayed. Probably Sam would have called it courage. He always goes for the best angle. And Rob would have called it pure stubbornness. But I don't flatter myself that it was either one. You can't take credit for what you do when your back is against the wall. That's nothing more than instinct, falling back on what you know best. I think I stayed because running seemed too strange and too complicated. All I knew was how to fall back, find a patch of solid ground, and then dig my heels in and fight to start over. Lexi had run. When exile somehow hit her out of a clear blue sky, she didn't fight it the way I did. She reached out for it with both hands, swallowed it whole, and made it her own. She had had the sense and the guts to let go of her ruined old self and walk away so simply, start over again, start fresh and clean as morning. And then, after all that, someone had strutted up to her and whipped that hard-won new life away, casually, as plucking a daisy. I felt a sudden zip of outrage, not at her, but for the first time, for her. "Whatever it is you want," I said softly into the dark cottage, "I'm here. You've got me." There was a tiny shift in the air around me, subtler than a breath, secretive, pleased. It was dark, big patches of cloud covering the moon, but I already knew the lane well enough that I barely needed the torch, and my hand went straight to the latch of the back gate, no fumbling. Undercover time works differently. It was hard to remember that I'd only been living there a day and a half. The house was black on black, only a faint crooked line of stars where the roof ended and the sky began. It seemed bigger and intangible, edges blurring, ready to dissolve into nothing if you came too close. The lit windows looked too warm and gold to be real, tiny pictures beckoning like old peep shows. Bright copper frying pans hanging in the kitchen. Daniel and Abby side by side on the sofa with their heads bent over some huge old book. Then a cloud skated off the moon, and I saw Rafe, sitting on the edge of the patio, one arm around his knees and a long glass in the other hand. My adrenaline leaped. There was no way he could have followed me without me seeing him, and I hadn't done anything dodgy anyway, but still, the look of him made me edgy. The way he was sitting, head up and ready, at the edge of that great spread of grass. He was waiting for me. I stood under the hawthorn tree by the gate and watched him. Something that had been taking shape in the back of my mind had just made it to the surface. It was the drama queen comment that had done it. The snide edge to his voice, the irritable eye roll. Now that I thought about it, Rafe had barely said a word to me since I arrived, apart from "pass the sauce" and "good night." He talked around me, at me, in my general direction. Never to me. The day before, he was the only one who hadn't touched me to welcome me home, just taken my suitcase and gone. He was being subtle about it, nothing overt, but for some reason, Rafe was pissed off with me. He saw me as soon as I stepped out from under the hawthorn. He raised his arm. The light from the window sent long, confusing shadows flying down the grass towards me, and watched, unmoving, as I crossed the lawn and sat down next to him. It seemed like the simplest thing to go with this head-on. "Are you mad at me?" I asked. Rafe turned his head away with a disgusted flick, looked out over the grass. "Mad at me?" he said. "For God's sake, Lexi, you're not a child." "Okay," I said. "Are you angry with me?" He stretched out his legs in front of him and examined the toes of his runners. "Has it even occurred to you," he asked, "to wonder what last week was like for us?" I considered this for a moment. It sounded a lot like he was in a snot with Lexi for getting stabbed. As far as I could see, this was either deeply suspicious or deeply bizarre. With this gang, it got hard to tell the difference. "I wasn't exactly having fun either, you know," I said. He laughed. "You haven't even thought about it, have you?" I stared at him. "That's why you're pissed off with me? Because I got hurt? Or because I didn't ask how you're feeling about it?" He shot me an oblique look that could have meant anything. "Well, Jesus, Rafe, I didn't ask for any of this to happen. Why are you being such a dickhead about it?" Rafe took a long, jerky swallow of his drink, gin and tonic. I could smell it. "Forget it," he said. "Never mind, just go inside." "Rafe," I said, hurt. I was only mostly faking it. There was an icy cut to his voice that made me flinch. "Don't." He ignored me. I put a hand on his arm. It was more muscular than I had expected, and warm right through his shirt, almost fever hot. His mouth set in a long, hard line, but he didn't move. "Tell me what it was like," I said. "Please. I want to know. Honestly, I do. I just didn't know how to ask." Rafe shifted his arm away. All right, he said. Fine. It was horrible beyond belief. Does that answer your question? I waited. We were all hysterical, he said harshly after a moment. We were wrecks. Not Daniel, obviously. He would never do anything as undignified as get upset. He just stuck his head in a book and occasionally came out with some fucking old Norse quote about arms that remain strong in times of trial or something. But I'm pretty sure he didn't sleep all week. No matter what time I got up, his light was still on. And the rest of us? Just to start with, we weren't sleeping either. We were all having nightmares. It was like some awful farce. Every time you managed to get to sleep, someone would wake up screaming, and of course that would wake everyone else up. Our sense of time completely disintegrated. Half the time I didn't know what day it was. I couldn't eat. Even the smell of food made me gag. And Abby kept baking. She said she needed to do something, but God, piles of gooey chocolate things and bloody meat pies all over the house. We had a blazing row about it, Abby and I. She threw a fork at me. I was drinking all the time so the smell wouldn't make me sick, and then of course Daniel started giving me flack about that. We ended up giving away the chocolate things in the tutorial groups. The meat pies are in the freezer if you're interested. None of the rest of us are going to touch them. Shaken up, Frank had said, but no one had mentioned this level of hysteria. Now that Rafe had started talking, he didn't know how to stop. The words were tumbling out hard and involuntary as vomiting. And Justin, he said, Jesus, he was the worst by a long shot. He couldn't stop shaking. I mean, really shaking. Some little smart-ass first year asked him if he had Parkinson's. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but it was incredibly unnerving. Every time you looked at him, even for a second, it set your teeth on edge. And he kept dropping things, and every time he did it, the rest of us nearly had heart attacks. Abby and I would yell at him, and then he would start crying like that was going to help anything. Abby wanted him to go to student health and get Valium or something, but Daniel said that was ridiculous. Justin had to learn to cope like the rest of us, which was obviously completely insane, because we weren't coping. The biggest optimist in the world couldn't have said we were coping. Abby was sleepwalking. One night, she ran herself a bath at 4 in the morning and got into it in her pajamas, fast asleep. If Daniel hadn't found her, she could have drowned. I'm sorry, I said. My voice sounded strange, high and shaky. Every word he said had hit me straight in the stomach with a kick like a horse's. I had argued this with Frank and talked it through with Sam. I thought I had my head around it, but it had never been real to me till that moment, what I was doing to these people. Oh, God, Rafe, I'm so sorry. Rafe gave me a long, dark, unreadable look. And the police, he said. He took another swig of his drink, made a face as if it tasted bitter. Have you ever had to deal with cops? Not like that, I said. I still sounded wrong, breathless, but he didn't seem to notice. They're bloody scary. These weren't uniformed cops fresh out of the bog. These were detectives. They have the best poker faces I've ever seen. You don't have a clue what they're thinking or what they want from you, and they were all over us. They questioned us for hours, almost every single day. And they make even the most innocent question. What time do you normally go to bed? Sound like a trap, like they're just waiting to whip out the handcuffs if you give the wrong answer. You feel like you have to be on your guard every second. It's fucking exhausting. And we were exhausted already. That guy who dropped you off, Mackie, he was the worst, all smiles and sympathy, but he obviously hated our guts right from the word go. He was nice to me, I said. He brought me chocolate biscuits. Well, isn't that charming, Rafe said. I'm sure that won your heart. Meanwhile, he was showing up here at all hours of the day and night, giving us the third degree about every single detail of your entire life and making bitchy little comments about how the other half live, which is complete bollocks anyway. Just because we've got the house and we go to college, the man's got a chip on his shoulder the size of Bolivia. He would have loved a reason to lock us all up. And of course, that got Justin even more hysterical. He was positive we were all going to be arrested